got about 25 minutes if nobody comes to yoga class. If they don't come to yoga class, we've got more. But assuming that someone will come, this is part two, existence of the soul. Last week we covered quite a bit of ground, and I'm just overlapping here with a couple of slides. This is the famous changing bodies, which is at the head of our stairway here. Comprises one of the main stations whenever we give a tour of the temple, one of our main tools in explaining reincarnation. And the gist of this picture is that the body's changing. Reincarnation, in fact, refers to something that's happening every moment, not just something that happens at the time of death. The literal meaning is, carnal means body, re means changing, and our bodies are changing every moment. We're shedding DNA, RNA. The body we have today is not exactly the same body we had yesterday. Tomorrow's body will then again be slightly different. But what doesn't change in all of this is the self, is the individual soul, the individual entity within the body. If we lived 80 years and if all the cells of our body die and are replaced by new ones every 7 to 10 years, that means that we'll have had 8 to 10 completely different bodies during that lifespan. But we're still the same person. We're just looking at life through different bodies, through different eyes, through different ears. And we mentioned last week, everything material goes through six changes: birth, growth, maintenance, production of byproducts, dwindling, and death. Even the universe itself is subject to these six changes. But we are not. So that means we are not material. If everything material is subject to these six changes and we don't change, that means we're not material. But we're made of some other entity. And in fact, the Bhagavad Gita explains that we're covered in two ways. The soul is covered in two ways. Just like if you go out and you're wearing a shirt and a coat on a brisk, chilly winter day. The coat is like the gross body that we have, made of earth, air, fire, water, mind, intelligence, and ether. And then the shirt is our subtle, or sometimes it's called the astral body, or the dream body, or the psyche. That's like the shirt. And it's made of three subtle elements: mind, intelligence, and false ego. So the physical body is like the coat, the outer covering. The psychic or mental body is like the shirt, or the inner covering. And then there's me and you, and we're separate from the shirt and the coat. The shirt and the coat can change, but we don't change. And so the soul is covered by gross and subtle coverings, as I mentioned. I don't know why all these things. This takes like half an hour to get through all these little things. In fact, I'm just trying to get past this slide to the next one. But it's going to take about 47 clicks. Yeah, we covered all this. That's why in my own slides, I don't use transitions. I don't use all these things because it wrecks your timing. It wrecks your rhythm altogether. So anyway, we finally, after 47 clicks, we come to the next slide. And that leads us to this verse. As the soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth and old age, similarly the soul passes to another body at death. In fact, we're always in the process of reincarnating. As long as we're in a material body, that body is in material, follows material rules and guidelines. It's in a constant state of flux and change. But we're not. We talked about this amply last week. The body itself is compared to a garment. It gets old. What happens when your garment gets old? You cast it aside and get a new one. So similarly, at the time of death, we leave aside this old and worn out material body and we accept a new one. Now, what will be our fate in the future life? In other words, if at every stage in this life there's a body ahead of us, if someone's in a 5-year-old body, 10 years from now they're going to be in a 15-year-old body, and every cell of that body will be different from the cells in the body of the 5-year-old. And a 15-year-old will have a 35-year-old body ahead of him. So even at the time of death, we have a body ahead of us. And in the same way that what we do when we're 15 years old in many ways determines what our body will look like and feel like at 35. If we sit on the couch and eat potato chips, our body's going to feel in a certain way at 35. If we go out and exercise and eat good wholesome foods, our body will look and feel a different way at 35. So what we do at 15 has a lot to do with how our body will look and feel at 35. Same principle. What we do in this life determines what type of a body we're going to get in the next life. we can get a material body, and in the material world, we can get a subhuman body, we can get a human body, we can get a superhuman body as a demigod, or if one acts in a spiritual way, that a spiritual body awaits one at the time of death. We've all had this experience. There's a body lying on the deathbed, and all the relatives and well-wishers are surrounding it, and they're all crying and moaning and gnashing their teeth and tearing their hair, and a bystander comes up and says, "What is everyone so upset about?" And they say, "Oh, Dad's gone. Dad's gone." And the bystander, just playing the devil's advocate, might say, "Well, why do you say that? You know, he's right there. You know, the same Dad that you talk to every day for many, many years, the same eyes, same hair, same hand that used to throw you baseballs. It's all there." And you say, "No, no, that's his body. Dad's gone." That means that Dad never was the body. And you never really saw Dad. You saw his body, his head, his arms, his eyes. But you never saw Dad himself. Because after Dad's gone, all the things that you were seeing, you're still seeing, but you say Dad's not there. So that means Dad was not seen by you physically, even when he was present before you. So consciousness is a proof for the soul. And every living being is his or her own proof of the existence of the soul. You don't need a certificate. You don't need someone else to verify for you that you're conscious. Consciousness doesn't have to be proved because it's self-evident. Everyone knows they're conscious. I don't need you to verify that I'm conscious or vice versa. And consciousness does not arise from matter. We showed this brick wall last week, and we talked about running your fist into it or ramming your car into it. Nobody in the history of the world ever heard a brick wall go, "Ouch." Just, it's never happened because it doesn't have consciousness. There is not a soul within the brick wall. But because we have feeling from the top of our head to the tip of our toes, we know it's self-evident to us that we are conscious, aware, thinking, feeling, willing, living beings. You can have a soul that says, "I see a red light." I mean, you can have a machine that says, "I see a red light," but the machine doesn't experience the red light in the same way that we do. It's just a mechanical process. A bunch of judges are looking at a drama, say a courtroom drama. Now, the things that go on, the testimony of the various witnesses and the protestations of innocence of the accused party, they give a certain experience. They make a certain impression in the eyes of the judges and the jurors. And they, in the end, they go into seclusion and they vote on whether that person is guilty or not based on the experience that they had from days and days of testimony. Now, a camera can record all the visuals, it can record all the audios, but the camera will not go into seclusion and with other cameras have a debate about the guilt or the innocence of the accused party. Because the camera did not experience the scene, the camera did not experience the visuals in as much as it was not conscious. These are some statistics here about near-death experiences. When people for a short period of time, quite often during surgeries, describe how they levitated from their body and in the operating room from a vantage point above the doctors, somewhere up near the light fixtures there, were looking down on the doctors operating them while they were under anesthesia and were able later on to describe everything in uncannily minute detail. 11 to 14% of the average American population who are mentally and physically healthy have had out-of-body experiences, according to the Medical Journal of Current Problems in Pediatrics. There's enough research in near-death experiences with impeccable scientific credentials. Research on eternal soul, 30 years by Dr. Bigelow. This is the result of 30 years of research by a surgeon, and he concludes that, in fact, everybody is inhabited by a soul. Dr. Ian Stevenson from University of Virginia, which is where I went for a couple of years, many, many years ago, did extensive studies, case studies, on past life experiences. He investigated over 2,000 cases of spontaneous reincarnation memories. And he has a lot of tapes, a lot of testimony on record. He's published a number of books. And the instances and the observations are extremely, extremely compelling. Someone sent me a video just the other day. It's on YouTube, of a little boy who's fascinated with fighter planes and aircraft carriers, and would wake up in the middle of the night screaming and kicking his legs and arms up in the air. And he said that he's been shot down. He's been shot down, and he can't get out of his plane. And in the course of investigating it, they said, well, what kind of a plane was it? And he immediately named the plane. He said, what carrier were you shot down from? He immediately named the carrier, the aircraft carrier. And there were some old men, some men that had fought in World War II, and they were still around. And so they went to, and he told him his name. He said his name, that he was shot down from a fighter pilot from this aircraft. And the boy is like 5 years old. And so they went, and they visited four or five of the guys. You know, they're much older now. They're like, you know, they're 80, whereas they were 20 when this happened. And they got them together. And the little boy, as soon as he went into the room, he said, you're Tom's Goodleaf. And he named all of their names, half a dozen of them, first name, last name. And they said, you could, you know, they had a conversation, and he remembered in minute detail a lot of things that nobody could have ever known if they had not actually been on that aircraft carrier, not been that person, and not been shot down. And these octogenarians, World War II veterans, they said, that's him. I don't know how or why, don't believe in reincarnation, but I'll tell you one thing. That is our former comrade in arms who was shot down in such and such and such and such a day. And everybody was convinced. This is a recent thing. I don't exactly know how to tell you to search for it on YouTube, but someone just sent it to me. So the soul is indestructible. It's eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. Its individual has form. This is sometimes a problem for people because they think of spirit as ineffable and wispy and insubstantial and misty. And they're kind of scared because, after all, we've got something. You know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I've got a mouth that I can chew with. I've got a nose that I can smell with. I've got fingers that I can touch with. I don't want to give it up, you know, in the favor of something less substantial. But why, for instance, is my shirt have a neck, arms, and a torso? Why is it created that way? Why is it tailored that way? It's tailored that way to fit my body, isn't it? So just take that reasoning one step further and ask, why is my body tailored this way? Why does my body have head, torso, legs, and arms? Because it's tailored to fit the soul. So the soul, although it's minute, it's in fact described as 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair, Keshaga Satyagabhaga, it has form. Even the seed of a banyan tree. In Calcutta, there's a banyan tree that spans like 5 acres. But a few hundred years ago, that whole tree, the form and the design of that tree to be, was contained within one small microscopic seed. So the soul is tiny, even submicroscopic, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have form. And the soul has sensation also. Another reluctance to relinquish this body stems from the fact that, well, I'm getting pleasure, tasting sin. And if I go... opt out for something spiritual, will then my sentiency be at an end? And the answer is no, just the opposite. We're not hardly feeling, seeing, tasting, touching, or smelling at all right now. This body does not promote sensation, it inhibits it. If I touch the texture of this microphone with my fingertips, there's a certain sensation, there's a certain texture that I can feel. Now, if I put a glove on, does that enhance the sensation or does it inhibit it? Obviously, it inhibits it. If I put 5 gloves on, further inhibit it. If I put 8 gloves on, then I'm hardly even feeling anything. And that's our situation. We're experiencing everything through 8 sheaths, 8 coverings. Earth covering, air covering, fire covering, water covering, ether covering are the 5 gross coverings. And the 3 subtle coverings are mind, intelligence, and false ego. So while we think the body is the source of our feelings, thinking, willing, nothing could be further than the truth. It's the soul that thinks, feels, and wills, and it's eight layers of bodily coverings that impede and inhibit the soul from experiencing life as intensely as life was meant to be experienced. So the soul does have form, and the soul does have sentiency. It's the soul that gives form to matter. These are the same points that I just covered, so I'll just skip through this. Soul leaves one body and occupies another body at death. This is known as the law of transmigration. First, the soul occupies a human body, and depending on his karma, he may occupy a donkey, cat's body, dog's body, cow's body, etc. When I went to the University of Virginia, and Dr. Ian Stevenson was presumably there when I was also there as an undergraduate, the fraternity fellows used to wait all week long for Saturday night to come. They would get out their kegs of beer and liquor, and they would get drunk, and they would go out on the roof and howl at the moon every Saturday night. And at that time, I hadn't been to India, I hadn't read the Bhagavad Gita, I hadn't got any grounding in reincarnation or Krishna consciousness. But even then, it occurred to me that they would be much better, much happier, much better situated as coyotes. Because they wouldn't have to wait till Saturday night, you know. They could do it Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, anytime they wanted to. And so we can see how, the consciousness that we form in this life can lead to assuming a certain type of body in the next life. A surfer could become a dolphin. A human being that sleeps more than he's awake could become a bear and hibernate for 6 months. Someone that likes to go nudie, exhibit. Well, you can exhibit yourself naked as a tree for 5,000 years at a stretch. And so the moral of the story is you get what you want, so be careful what you want. Karma means action and reaction. And if you have a human body, but you haven't used it in the unique purposes, for the unique purposes that the human body is gifted to you, then why should you get a human body the next time around? If we squander the intelligence and the resources of the human life only for pursuing the animal-like pleasures of eating, sleeping, mating, defending, then the next time after the soul leaves the human body, it's not going to get another human body. It'll have to devolve at least a few rungs on the evolutionary ladder in order to then again, hopefully, ascend to a human form a second time and get another chance, hopefully having learned the lesson in those subhuman forms. One point I like to make is that one does not accrue karma either in the higher forms, nor does one accrue karma in the lower forms. If you were to take birth from here in a superhuman body, it would be the result of pious charitable works you've done in this life. And you would be burning up the good reactions to those pious charitable works, and at such time as they were exhausted, you would come back and take birth as a human being. So as a demigod, as a superhuman, you're only burning up the karma that you created in a human being. The flip side of the coin is if you take a subhuman body, the body of an animal, you would be burning up the bad karma that you had accrued as a human being. But as a demigod or an animal, you do not accrue karma. You only accrue karma in the human form of life, and then you burn it up in the sub or superhuman forms of life. Now here's Prahlad Maharaj. He took the opportunity. He was forced to go to a mundane school, but whenever there would be a recess or free time, he would take all of his students, his classmates, out into the recess area, and he would get them chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And sometimes the children, they liked it. In fact, children take to chanting Hare Krishna even more naturally than adults. But they would make a mild inquiry sometimes. They said, Prahlad, we're young. We don't have to. Why should we worry about this God stuff? We have 50, 70 years ahead of us. Maybe we can just play and enjoy, do nonsense things now and take care of that kind of business when we get old, when the sap of life is dried up. And Prahlad said, Komaram acharat pragna dharma bhagata durlabham manusyam janma tadapya durva martira. He says that from the age of 5, one should instigate spiritual life. And hopefully, one's parents will be astute enough to set their offspring on the spiritual path as early as 5 years old. Traditionally, the student would go to the Gurukul at the age of 5. not necessarily as a boarder, but just a day student. And the role of the guru, as opposed to the parents, was to begin at the age of five to instruct the student in Sanatana Dharma, the eternal nature of the soul and the difference between that and the body. Because we're not all guaranteed a full life of 70 or 80 years. We have no idea how long we're going to live. We don't even know if we're going to be here tomorrow. And so there's no time when it's too early to begin to learn about the nature of the soul and to bring about the ultimate liberation of the soul from the cycle of repeated birth and death. So if we're soul, we immediately run into a conundrum. We know God's spirit, and once we discover we're spirit, there's a temptation there. In fact, there's a logical sort of allurement. If A equals B and C equals B, then the temptation is to say A equals C. So we apply that to our present situation. God is spirit, I'm spirit, right? A equals B, C equals B, then A equals C. God is spirit, I'm spirit, therefore I'm God. That's the pitfall. That's the main pitfall. After realizing that you're spirit, the main pitfall is to think that you're God. But one must pause there and consider soberly, if I'm God, am I in control? Am I supremely independent? Did I create the universe? If I'm God, why am I suffering and why am I undergoing the cycle of birth, death, disease, and old age? The fact is, I am controlled. I'm not the controller. I am dependent. I'm not independent. So we're forced to conclude that though God and I are spirit, there are different categories of spirit. There is the supreme spirit, and then there are the subordinate spirits. Just like in America, I'm a citizen, I'm an American, Obama's an American, so we share our Americanness. However, he is the head American, and I am one of the 300 million citizen Americans. Qualitatively, we have a oneness, but quantitatively, there's a difference, that I am controlled by Obama, Obama is not controlled by me, so to speak. Of course, because we're coming from God, we do have each one of us our area of sovereignty. Like Jerry, he brings home the veggie bacon and he provides for his beautiful wife and child. And he also has constituents in his business also. He's a manager and all like that. But he also has managers to whom he has to answer. They have managers to whom they have to answer. So we're controllers, but we're not independent controllers. We're controllers, but we're also controlled. You go up the ladder, there's always someone up the ladder above us. Only when you get to that person that there's nobody up the ladder higher than them, they're the cause of all causes, they control everyone, nothing controls them, then you've arrived at God, the supreme controller. The fact that we are parts and parcels of God allows us some measure of control. Here's a picture of a jet plane. And that jet plane is a huge jet plane. And you see that little that cockpit, that little window there? I mean, in terms of the overall mass of the plane, that cockpit area probably doesn't comprise more than 1/100th of the whole. And yet that's where all the control comes from. That's where all the control comes from. In fact, in our body, which may be 5'5", or 6'2", and weigh 180 or 220 pounds, all the control comes from the heart. And it comes from a little driver in the heart who's 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair. Like that. So, we are tiny and God is infinite. We're infinitesimal and God is infinite. We can put a satellite into orbit. God can float millions of planets. What are the planets but satellites? Just big, huge satellites, and God is floating them in space like they were little pieces of cotton. Man can create a 100-story building, and God can create millions and millions of universes. That's why we're called Jiva, Jivatma, and God is called Paramatma. Jiva means tiny soul, and Paramatma means supreme soul. And wherever you find a tiny individual soul in a particular body, you find accompanying that tiny soul, the supreme soul. So the tiny soul is localized to one particular field of activities, but the supreme soul is all pervasive. The supreme soul is in every single body as the super soul. In the other religions, he might be called the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit, but we call him Param Atma, the supreme soul. This is a nice phraseology here. I like this. Not sure what poem it's from, It says, we are not gods, but we are gods. We are not gods, G-O-D-S, but we are gods, G-O-D, apostrophe S. And that apostrophe means possessive. We're not gods, in other words, we're not independent, but we are G-O-D, apostrophe S, which means we're possessed. We are someone else's property. And so it says here, I am a tiny jiva, not the ultimate God, a tiny part and parcel, servant of the Lord. Leaving the Lord's company, we're forced to be born in pain in a world filled with agony again and again. I guess this is the poem. I'm not sure what it is I'm reading here. Krishna is my Lord, the source of all existence. His form is imperishable, full of six opulences. He pays a visit to this world out of his own sweet will to please and protect his devotees and punish the evil. I'm going to just skip through this because I'm not sure what this actually is here. If it's a poem, it doesn't rhyme. So here, let's summarize what we talked about. We've got two more slides left, and we will have finished this series of two parts. Summary, what we've talked about. We talked last week, we are not these bodies, we are spirit soul. Just as a car cannot move without a driver, the body cannot function without the soul. The presence of the soul can be scientifically proven by common sense, intuitive understanding, presence of consciousness, near-death experiences, as well as past life memories. The gross body, the covering of the soul, is made up of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. The subtle body is made up of intelligence and ego. A computer or a robot can never become like a human being with any amount of advancement because it is a machine devoid of consciousness. Doesn't experience things. Doesn't have a soul. The soul, on the other hand, is indestructible, individual, internal, inconceivable, situated in the region of the heart, I mentioned, Keshaga Satika Bhaga. Keshaga Satika Bhaga. Keshaga means hair, Satika means 1/100th, and Bhaga means divide. So if you pluck a hair and you divide into 100 parts, Purnarsha Tamshakari, then you take that 1/100th and then you divide that into 100 parts, what you have, for conceptualization's sake, is 1/10,000th the size of a tip of hair. That gives us an idea of the length and breadth of the soul. It exists in the region of the heart, and it drives the whole body. It drives the whole body. And as soon as it leaves the body is useless. It's worth about, you know, $21 worth of chemicals. So, situated in the heart, it is not formless. It has a form. That's why this body is tailored as it is. It's tailored to go over the form of the soul. It is sentient also. It leaves one body, goes to another body at the time of death. It never ceases to exist, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. It is never born, it never dies. It is eternal, undying, primeval. It is not slain when the body is slain. It is full of knowledge and bliss. And as I mentioned, it's 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair. So in conclusion, the soul does not spring from anything material. The soul springs from an entirely different dimension, entirely different world. And rather than being caught up in karma, and rather than continue to condition ourselves materially in terms of family, friends, and country, and bodily considerations, yoga, from which we get the English word yoke, is that process of reconnecting ourselves to the spiritual world and to the supreme spiritual person from which we come. So at the end of this life, our consciousness can be pure, and we will not have to take another material body, but our consciousness being attracted to service of the Supreme Lord will gravitate back home, back to Godhead. And we will have thus solved all of the problems of life and reattain that realm where life is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. Thank you very much. We'll talk about something else next Tuesday. These Tuesday night classes, just as a caveat, these are called membership classes. The Sunday classes we give are seeker presentations for people who are coming for the first time and they're curious, and we tailor presentations on Sunday for what we call seekers. Those who have expressed an interest in learning more about the nuts and bolts of Krishna consciousness and Bhagavad Gita, for that purpose we have these classes during the week. And these classes are a little bit more matter of fact, a little bit more academic, a little bit more factual. And thus there's a difference in tone between these classes and the Sunday classes. These are meant to be more instructional. The Sunday classes are meant to be more inspirational. And there you have it. Om Tat Sat.